This episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast is brought to you by ComAvia, delivering leading-edge media to the aviation industry. ComAvia, the company the aviation industry turns to for the best in new media marketing communications. Visit them at commavia.com. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 295 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'd like to introduce my co-hosts. First, we have Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening from beautiful Chicago, and I'm not even going to mention the fact that it's almost tax day, and it's snowing!
That's awful. That's sorry. Awful. That should be illegal.
I think so.
Also joining us as co-host, of course, is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. Hi, David.
Hey, guys. Had a fantastic weekend and looking forward to a really good show tonight.
Well, it should be a good show because we have a great guest, kind of a character. We're joined by Steve Frischling. Steve, or Fish as he is known, is a travel social media guy. He's also a blogger, and maybe he's the one man who can give Rob a run for his money when it comes to having an opinion. So, Fish, welcome to the show.
I just want Rob to know that I'm sitting in my car by the beach in Connecticut, and it's really, really lovely. My windows are down with a nice warm breeze coming in.
Yeah, well, that's not going to last long, baby, let me tell you. In fact, when I did our promo, because we do a promo every week with the NBAA, and I called you a guy that is on Twitter and Facebook more than any 10 people I've ever met.
Because I have no life.
Yeah. Well, I was, we got to talk about that because you must have this thing attached to your hand. Your smartphone, because you're always on Facebook and it's always something new.
You mean other than I'm sitting here right now talking to you with two iPhones, an iPad mini, and a MacBook?
You're well prepared. All right. All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about some of the aviation news from the past week. And we've got David's Airplane of the Week. We continue the series this time, David?
Yeah, this is part 3 of 4, and we're talking about the international versions of the P3 Orion.
Great. We also have an Australia desk report. The boys lead off with a story about Hainan Airlines' parent company signing an MOU with the Avalon Airport owners. They're going to spend 18 months expanding Avalon to prepare for a Melbourne-China route. Also, they're going to talk about Victoria's Premier, who promises to build a rail link from Melbourne CBD to the airport. And also, Air Marshal Mark Binskin. He's promoted to the Chief of Defense Force. And Grant recently recorded an interview with him, so we've got that coming up. And then, Rob, we do have an aviation minute this week, don't we?
We're going to talk about SATs, and nobody knows what that is, but that's a synthetic air traffic control system for non-towered airports that a fellow I know is creating, and it's really cool.
And also coming up in his Across the Pond segment, Peter gets a little nostalgic. He goes back to the spot 40 years ago at London Heathrow where he watched planes come in as a young boy. And he's going to talk about that. He's also got a couple of suggestions for museums to visit, so we'll look forward to those. And we also have a sampling of some of the listener mail we've recently received, and we'll close with that. Okay, so with that, why don't we get started with the news? Are you guys all ready?
Ready.
Well, we'll start off with a story from CNN.com. This is a real shocker. This is titled, Spirit Airlines Tops Complaint List. Well, there's a report out, and this is by the U.S. PIRG Education Fund. It's titled, The Unfriendly Skies, 5 Years of Airline Passenger Complaints to the DOT. Now, this report analyzes complaints to the U.S. Department of Transportation's Aviation Consumer Protection Division, and it found that in 2013, Spirit Airlines had three times the complaint rate as the next worst airline, which was Frontier, followed by United Airlines and American Airlines. And if that's not bad enough, if you look at the little chart there, Spirit Airlines numbers are growing each year. So it's getting worse, not better.
As David would say, and you're surprised at this, why?
You know, there are very few airlines that can make Ryanair look very attractive. Spirit's one of them.
And you know what? The worst part, they didn't used to be this bad. I mean, we used to fly them 10 years ago out of O'Hare. They used to have service down to Tampa. When we had a house.
I mean, when Spirit still had reclining seats and didn't charge you for carry-on baggage.
Oh, absolutely. And they were actually pretty nice. And then they made that switch, that turn. And I can't even imagine. In fact, it's funny, I was down in Dallas the other day for a talk, and I was talking to somebody about Spirit specifically, and she said it was excruciating when she was on not long ago because she sat next to a very tall fellow. And his feet could not reach the floor because his knee, he couldn't straighten out his legs. So his knees were sort of up in the air against the back of the seat in front of him for the whole trip. And I thought, why would anybody fly these guys?
Have you met most of the people who fly?
That's right. Wasn't there something, too, about the fact that Spirit has more... or maybe this lady told me this, that more the cops meet the airplanes more than anybody else or something?
Well, they're the most profitable airline in the U.S. And it's because people look at it and go, wow, that's a $9 fare until you add up all the costs, and it's more than Southwest on many routes.
Well, this is something that I don't quite understand. I mean, why do people seem to make their purchase decisions, their selections, based on that, you know, that base fare and not consider all the other fees and things that go into what they're going to pay in the end? How come people don't do that?
They're not as smart as you.
Do you want to pay $9.99 plus $3 shipping or $11 of free shipping? People pay $9.99 and they pay $3 shipping because it was a penny less.
It just baffles me. I can't explain it. But like I said, it's true. I mean, people do go for that base price. And
I am amazed at the amount of email I get and other people who write blogs and who are on Twitter get wanting help with airlines because they bought the super saver fare that should have been $200 for $59, and then they want to cancel it and are furious the airline won't give them their money back. Which part of non-refundable didn't you get? Or the people who show up who are shocked that, oh my God, they're charging me for baggage. And you just, and it's always the same story of, I fly all the time and I've never seen this before. Have you flown since 2006? You know, it's the, yeah. My favorite story of these types of passengers comes this summer, from this past summer, flying Finnair at a JFK. Finnair is a direct competitor with SAS. Obviously, they are the two main competitors in that region. This woman is standing at the Finnair counter, waving her SAS gold card around, demanding an upgrade because she flies them all the time.
Well, they're pretty close to Finland.
Yeah. I mean, sure. It's like, welcome to Norway, Finn, Denmark, land. I mean, like, it's whatever. You're all Swedish. It's fine.
And here I thought Fish was invented a new airline because I kept thinking he was saying Finnair, T-H-I-N. They were flying Finnair.
No. That's the diet you get before you fly Spirit. If you want to fit in the seat, you've got to starve yourself for a month.
No. That's what happens to you after you take off. You dissolve into thin air. Oh, my God. All right.
Well, this sounds like, you know, overall, it's kind of a problem of incomplete knowledge or lack of complete understanding of what the pricing is like and what the service is like associated with the different levels of pricing and fees and so forth. There are a number of sites that try to provide that kind of information, and I guess people just aren't aware of them or don't know to use those resources when they're traveling, huh?
I read the stuff on Twitter all day long because that's part of my job, is tracking the inbound traffic of people complaining to airlines, and I am amazed what people complain about. I mean, it really, it is shocking, the stuff that is I would envision to be basic knowledge. Like, why can't I randomly go to the airport and just change my flight? Why can't I skip a flight? What if I want to bring my entire set of golf clubs on board? The all-time favorite thing for the past 2 months for me is anybody who flies Southwest knows that the entire cabin is one type of seat, one end to the other. This person was complaining bitterly that they paid one of the business fares, and they were forced to sit in the same size seat as everybody else on the aircraft.
Did you see that one today from U.S. Airs with the lady that was showing everyone how displeased she was?
You mean the way she was torturing the 777?
Yes.
Yes, I did see that. Actually, I believe that that was actually a message from U.S. Airways to American Airlines social media team about what integration is going to be like when they bring the two units together.
Oh, no.
And I'm going to get some serious hate mail from Americans for that one tomorrow.
This report, which comes from a kind of a consumer watchdog sort of a group, they made some recommendations. And based on the conversation we just had, I'm not sure that any of these would kind of change the situation. But the report recommendations include things like recommending that the Department of Transportation establish a searchable public database of consumer airline complaints to supplement its monthly summary reports. That the DOT move more of its air travel databases into the machine-readable data.gov platform. Others, policymakers, provide funding for the unfunded air passenger consumer complaint hotline, which was established in 2012, and that the DOT require airlines to report complaint data about frequent flyer programs separately so that it can be added to the data that are available in DOT reports and in the future searchable public consumer complaint database. What do you think? Would those things make any significant difference to the complaints experienced by travelers?
No.
I am sure some consultant would make a lot of money making it exist.
You know, I think to me it's a lot like when the Malaysian airplane went missing and they suddenly found out that two of the passengers had climbed on board with stolen passports. And they said these passports were listed among, I don't know, 20 or 30 million stolen passports in the Interpol database. But having a great database is useless if no one looks at it.
Right.
Well, here's the thing with the missing passports. Only the U.S., the U.K., and the UAE actually check the Interpol lists, although not consistently. So for all the stuff we hear in the U.S. about what DHS and CBP are doing, they're not even consistently tracking the Interpol stolen database list.
Now, how do you know that?
Because according to Interpol, it's only accessed by the U.S., the U.K., and the UAE regularly.
No, I guess I was asking how you know that the U.S. and U.K. and whatever don't check it all the time.
Because they would have tens of millions more hits annually.
Hmm.
Simple math.
That's interesting.
They're not checking my passport because they're only X number of seats are flying daily, but the only percentage they're being checked against the system. And as I understand it, the UAE checks percentage-wise more than the U.S. and the U.K.
Wow.
Yeah. That's kind of a shocker.
I mean, it's one of those, like, what are we putting all of our money into? Oh, right. In the U.S. alone, the DHS and TSA, which are the same because the TSA is part of the DHS, have two conflicting systems for checking your background. One is called Paris, one is called PIS. They basically do the same thing, but they're two completely incompatible systems.
Hmm. What's the second one again?
One is called Paris, and one's called PIS, T-I-S-S.
I thought he said something rude, but I'm sorry.
Yes, that's not what I said. Oh, but I can make numerous comments in that direction, but I won't. Okay. But yeah, I mean, it's a complete joke. You look at it and go, okay, so why are we doing all this? I mean, not to mention that we know there's at least third, possibly fourth, confirmed stolen passport on board the flight, but no one's talking about it. Like, there's a Russian guy who was denied boarding the aircraft because his passport was stolen that day. We know he's alive, and we know that he was standing at the airport in Kuala Lumpur going, why can't I board the plane? I need a passport. And somehow he's on the manifest of people who were scanned on board the aircraft. Oops.
Yeah.
You know, there's the Chinese guy who is alive and well somewhere in China and who has been on TV showing his documents going, I'm alive. Why am I on the list of people who was on the plane? I was never in Kuala Lumpur.
No.
I mean, it sounds insensitive, but if I wanted to make a Saturday Night Live skit about that flight, I'd have endless material for years. But I would never do that.
Of course. Well, you know, another aspect of the flying experience is what you encounter at the airport. And sometimes you're kind of held captive at the airport. I mean, you're there, you can't really go anywhere, but you do need to spend a lot of time there sometimes between flights or in advance of your flight. Of course, spending a lot of time in airports, you have to eat something. And we saw in the Denver Post that the Denver International Airport is trying to, provide better dining experiences for the folks at the airport. They're partnering with restaurants to try to bring better food to the airport. And sometimes that includes some pretty nice meals. Other times it's things as simple as hot dogs. And I know that Fish and Rob had a little exchange concerning hot dogs in the past week at airports.
No, there was no exchange. No, I mean, you know, I think what's his name from over there is entitled to his opinion about whatchamacallit. But we all know that Chicago dogs are the best.
I was going to go with the fat really debate because I'm right. If it's not a hot dog from New York, it sucks. It's really just that simple. Everything else wants to be a New York City hot dog, but it fails miserably, much like pizza.
Well, Fish, do you have some favorite airports or some favorite airport restaurants, places to travel where the food is particularly good at the airport?
You know, surprisingly, it's a sub shop at Midway in Chicago.
So, which one is that?
I'll give you a guess. How many decent sub shops are the sandwich shops are there at Midway?
I'm trying. You know, it's a funny thing, but I always end up going down the same B concourse all the time. So if it's up the A concourse, I'd never even know it was there.
Oh, Potbelly sandwiches.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. They are pretty good for a chain. That is pretty good. But I have to admit that the New York pizza is. I really, really have grown to love that.
And I'm the oddball. I mean, despite the fact I'm a native New Yorker.
Were we recording? Max, did we get that? When Fish said, I'm the oddball, we got to find a way to use that. Okay.
You mean despite being the Red Sox fan, I grew up next to, you know, Shea Stadium?
There you go. Well, you know, maybe this is a good question for our listeners to find out what airports provide the best food. You know, there's food at the airport, and there's sort of aviation-themed restaurants sometimes in the airport, sometimes right around the airport. But my favorite is, it's called the Airport Diner. Isn't that original? It's just outside the Manchester, New Hampshire airport. That's my favorite airport dining location. Just for great food. But maybe we could ask our listeners, you know, if they have some suggestions about which airports have the best food. Maybe we can see what that list looks like.
Flight Deck Diner at Cape May Airport.
Yeah, that's a good one.
It's great. And they post their specials every day on Facebook.
Ooh, I like that idea.
I can't even think of any because I'm always in and out of airports in 30 seconds. Like, food for me is, I just eat on a plane.
I personally was expecting to say that you like cheesesteaks at Philadelphia, Fish.
I don't mind cheesesteaks, actually, but the food in PHL is not that good.
Thanks a lot.
I know, not in the city, in the airport itself.
I know, but what happens when you get rescued from the locals?
Well, I go to your place. You know, wherever the Vanderhoofs say is a good place to eat is where I'll go and eat.
So I guess the question is, do we think this is a trend? Airports providing decent...
In Terminal 5 at Heathrow, Gordon Ramsay now has a restaurant, but it's interesting in that they have takeaway food in these little insulated bags, like, so it'll keep the food fairly fresh for about an hour if you're going to buy it, get through security, you know, and get to your flight, which is a pretty good idea. And it's fairly reasonably priced, which... outside of an airport, for what it's served, I would rather die than pay for. But in an airport, it's incredibly reasonable.
I mean, it sounds like a great idea. And, I mean, certainly the airline's not going to give you a good meal.
Oh, my God, no. Some guy next to me on American the other day was complaining about the $7 bagel with whatever on it. And it's like, what are your other options? We got 4 hours between Hartford and Dallas. You can either eat the $7 bagel or be hungry.
No, I miss American Airlines because when I used to fly out to Chicago... I'd get the morning flight, and American Airlines had a grab and go. They had a big cooler.
Oh, I remember that on the jetway.
At the big cooler at the end of the jetway, and you grab two bag breakfasts, and it was a bagel and a yogurt and an orange juice or whatever. But they were great, and they were inexpensive.
You know how old you sound right now.
Well, sorry, but it made perfect. It was made perfect sense. I'd even throw them like $5 to grab the same breakfast. You know, I mean, it couldn't have cost them more than $2 or $3 for that bag breakfast. You know,
like 10 years ago at least.
Oh no, it's more like 20. But
is it? In that case, I'm really old also. But you know, so.
But no, it was great. I mean, it was really inexpensive way to solve the solution. Nobody complained. Everybody got their little bag, and if you were lucky and you snuck by, you got two of them, and you could eat it on the plane, and they'd pick up the trash, and it was great.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about drones. I see we have an article coming up. This is in AIN Safety. Is that right, Rob? European Commission begins developing rules on drones.
Yes, and I think it was kind of interesting because they already seem to have kind of grabbed hold of the bull by the horns here, as we say in the States, and they're already working on rules because people are chomping at the bits in Europe to use these things just like they are here. But they're already moving far ahead. In fact, one piece that I didn't have room to put in there, one quote was that the Europeans think that they want to become the leaders in the world with unmanned aerial systems. So that's why they're jumping ahead right now.
Well, there's a lot of money involved in this. There are a lot of opportunity to make a lot of money, don't you think, David?
Yeah, there's a lot of money out there, but I don't think they're... I think they're still playing catch-up. I mean, as far as rulemaking, they may be ahead of the curve, but as far as manufacturing and producing, they got a long way to go to catch up to the Israelis in the United States.
In this story, I think they were really talking more about just getting them up and operating in European airspace and the challenges of having national borders so close to each other. That would, some unique challenges that the United States doesn't face. But manufacturing, yeah, I don't think they could even that's probably why they didn't even address that.
Well, I was thinking of you. Did you see Dassault's big picture last week that they debuted about their leading edge aircraft?
Oh, yeah.
And in front of your beloved Falcon.
I know.
Was their UAV?
Yeah.
So that should tell you where their priorities are.
And you couldn't tell which was the Falcon and which was the UAV, right?
No, you could clearly tell what was what. And the Rafale behind it was trailing behind.
You know, the one aspect of this that when I think of the Europeans, they have different definitions, different views on privacy. And, of course, no matter where you're talking about unmanned vehicles or drones or UAS, I mean, the issue of privacy comes up because there are such great devices to kind of invade that. But the Europeans have generally much more strict views of privacy and that sort of thing. And, you know, they may run into some difficulty creating the rules, the guidelines, the regulations that don't infringe on their definitions of privacy. So it'll be interesting to see how they work that out, I think.
Well, I mean, if you talk about drones, are we talking about the Phantom or are we talking about a Global Hawk? Because they both fall under drone.
Right, sure.
And a Phantom, you can go and buy on Amazon, and the RQ-4 that my 9-year-old really wants is a bit harder to launch from my street. Although he absolutely wants one for his birthday.
Yeah, is he going to get something?
An RQ-4? No, I don't think Northrop Grumman will sell me that.
How about the Phantom?
Well, the Phantom probably I could pick up off of Amazon, but he really wants the Grumman Global Hawk.
Okay.
promises not to do anything illicit with it.
Well, where's the fun in that?
Yeah.
Given that I live next to a nuclear power plant in a town with an army base next to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, up the street from the world's largest nuclear submarine base next to where GD makes the nuclear subs, I can't see what problem I would have.
We could tell you a story we did last week about a guy that was flying a DJI Phantom over a nuclear power plant. What happened to him in England?
Yeah, he didn't fare too well. His wallet got lightened significantly.
Yeah, by 3,500
pounds. Yeah, people want to play with him here, and they end up with the DOD police going, hi, can we have a conversation?
Right.
So, like, we're in the local park on the beach. What do you mean I can't use this? It's, I mean, and it's always the DOD police is very polite, can we have a conversation line, which really isn't apparently much of a conversation.
Yeah, it tends to be kind of one-sided.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to our last item. This is from Forbes. This talks about Delta and how they are challenging Boeing in the Export-Import Bank. The U.S. Export-Import Bank, which is popularly called the Ex-Im Bank, it's actually a credit agency that was established really way back in 1934, and it finances exports of U.S. products to foreign buyers. The kind of the original idea, the charter behind this, is that sometimes there are those in other countries that would like to procure products and services from the U.S., but for whatever reason, they can't obtain financing to do that. And so the bank steps in, the Ex-Im Bank steps in to do that. And over the years, the Ex-Im Bank has funded some really interesting and worthwhile things. But more recently, it turns out that a huge portion of the funding goes towards buyers of Boeing jets. Well, Delta and the Airline Pilots Association, ALPA, have a problem with the bank. And there's been a recent charter hearing because their charter expires in September. So the U.S. Congress has to vote to extend that. But the criticism is that the Ex-Im Bank funds or finances airlines that don't really have any problem coming up with financing, like Middle Eastern airlines, for example. And Delta and the ALPA say that that really damages jobs in the U.S. because these other airlines, these foreign airlines, are able to buy aircraft at lower prices than the domestic airlines do.
Well, this started up in 2011, I think, with Air India, if I recall. My numbers may be a bit off, but Delta had an issue, or the airline pilots had an issue with the $3.4 billion Ex-Im loan for the 787s to Air India, and the U.S. government, or was it ATA, had a problem with it? It was one of them. They had a problem with it because they were trying to, put together the $3.4 billion package to Air India for the 787s. But they said if they didn't get the deal from Ex-Im, it was going to impact the $5 billion deal for the C-17s and the GF-404 engines, and then a $2.1 billion deal for the PA Poseidons. So Ex-Im looks at it and says, okay, we have to do that. And they came up with $100 million for the Boeing Air India MRO facility in where the heck was it, Nagpur? So, I mean, there's a whole purpose for them screwing over the U.S. airlines, essentially.
Hopefully the Ex-Im Bank is looking at it from a sort of holistic standpoint. And what's the net value to U.S. Companies by providing this financing? Not just does this help Delta or hurt Delta or the ALPA. But it is kind of complex. And I don't really have a sense for, where this is going to go. I think part of the reason for this hearing was so that the politicians could start to, think about the issues. But this could head in a couple of different directions, I think, depending on what the Congress wants to do and who they listen to and who's got the power to influence them. So it's probably going to be pretty political in the end.
Isn't everything? You know what Tip O'Neill always said, right?
That's right.
All politics is local. So, it's local to somebody.
So, again, we're talking with Steve Frischling, a fish, flying with fish. Can you tell us, Steve, what are all the sort of properties out there that you're part of in the online world these days?
I don't know where to begin with that. I don't know what my job is anymore. For the past 2 years, I tell people I build jigsaw puzzles. That's the only way to really describe what I do. I build jigsaw puzzles.
Okay.
And you can kind of figure part of my jigsaw puzzles out if you... I do it mostly on Twitter, just because it's the easiest way to do it, and 140 characters, and... due to my total lack of attention span, it works out quite well. I play a lot with aviation security still. I don't know how else to describe it as playing with it. I tend to be ahead of things. I try and figure out how airlines and increasingly hospitality companies are dealing with various aspects of the customer experience and passenger experience and revenue and all sorts of really incredibly boring stuff through social media. And, and then I try and figure out other parts of security where I'm not actually covering security, but I'm figuring security out for companies, which is often kind of fun because I end up with jobs like about a year ago, I did 58,000 miles in 5 weeks where I just flew all over and went nowhere. I had 2 weeks in a row where I went to both Moscow and Honolulu in the same week.
Wow.
Ouch.
It's a lot of time.
Yeah, it's freezing or shorts, but I spent 90 minutes, and I think my longest time in Honolulu was 90 minutes, and my longest time in Moscow was 6 hours where I had the strangest interaction with a lounge representative who apparently was also a hooker. That was very awkward, by the way.
Aren't they all there? I thought that's how they made a living.
Don't say that, Rob.
Like, oh, you like me now? We have showers. You know what? I'm going to go sit by the gate. Have a good night. Well, it was weird.
That's a little bit something that you don't really expect in the travel experience. But other than that, who in your mind is doing things really well?
Surprisingly, it's American. 2 years ago, I would have said, bury them and bury the shovel you buried them with, because they're done. Delta came out of nowhere. They were the worst to become really, really good, and now they're sort of middle of the pack for decent. And not the good decent either, more the I'm being polite decent. But Americans really got it down well. Southwest has devised an interesting way of handling a lot of its social stuff and customer interaction, where you sort of, tweet the main account, and somebody from the sub-account or their personal account will get back to you. I think they do that really, really well. I think United has a lot of potential and has no idea what to do with it. Spirit, I think, absolutely sucks. Oh, we already covered that, didn't we?
Yeah, we talked about it. Yeah, right.
Okay. WestJet, but they're Canadians. I mean, they have to be polite, right?
Sure.
Lufthansa, from the German side, does really well. I like KLM, but I'm incredibly biased towards KLM. And it depends what you're looking for. But the overall customer experience, I would say, if we're looking at social, goes to American. Overall, they're on the ball. They're very responsive, and not only are they responsive, they're humorous. I mean, their actual frontline customer service reps are out there making real conversations with people, which breaks down an interesting barrier of turning a faceless corporation into a very warm and engaging company.
Any thoughts on why they changed in that way?
If your customers like you, they give you money. It's really that simple.
And did they just wake up one day and kind of understand that all of a sudden?
They hired in some new people who were really good, who got that, and then allowed their frontline staff to actually embrace that, which is great. You look at some companies who just dial it back so much. One of American's main competitors, if you look at their account on any given day, you will see somebody tweet them and saying, I was bumped from my flight. My father is in the hospital on a ventilator. I have to get home. And they will tweet them back, thank you for flying United. Please call 1-800. We don't care. It's like, really? I mean, I know that someone in my family was stuck in Denver with a blizzard with a 8-week-old puppy trying to get home. And I tweeted United 8 or 9 times, and I was telling them, I can't get through on your phone line. You have flights available with seats. I want to give you money. And they never answered me. And I mean, my last couple of tweets were literally like, don't make me tweet my Amex card in public. But I will, if it will get me the damn seat. Never responded. Versus Southwest, immediately got back to me and had the puppy on the first flight out in the morning. They actually got somebody else's flight shifted around so the puppy could get out of the airport and home. And then another one of the puppies in the litter had to go home as an emergency, and they had one of their staff members volunteer their time to fly the dog where it had to go in their own free time.
Wow.
You've got to love that.
I guess you've got to have the will and you've got to have the capacity. And I would imagine that it takes a lot of resources for an airline to be responsive, right? Because the volume of these kinds of things can get so large. I mean, it must require a big staff.
The staffs aren't as large as you'd think. It's more a matter of training and software. and a number of the airlines have absolutely no idea how to use the software. None at all. I mean, it is entirely apparent. But you also have some airlines that you read the inbound stuff, because I don't just read what the airlines are giving out. I search both ends of that conversation. I want to know what they're responding to or not responding to, so I search what people are writing to them. Some of the stuff is just ridiculous. I mean, I have a Twitter account that is not largely in use, but it's STFU_FLY, and I sort of answer people back about what the airlines want to answer them but can't.
Like, can you give me an example?
Yeah, well, I can give you an easy one. JetBlue, who does amazing social media, I think that their team is fantastic.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we've talked about that a lot.
Fantastic stuff. They're kind of in a league of their own. But people were going on about the weather in February and March grounding flights. And I was just responding to people like, so you want to take off on a runway that the Port Authority has deemed to be unsafe with an aircraft that's covered in ice that the FAA says is unsafe. Why? You know the airline wants to say that. Or the person who was complaining that they diverted for a medical reason, and how come we're on the ground so long? Really? Your flight diverted for a guy having a cardiac problem, and you're complaining because your flight landed so he wouldn't die? Like, who are you, and how did your parents not raise you properly? Mm. But that fake account, I know, I mean, it's a real account, but it answers, you know, stuff in a way that the airlines, I know, would, having spoken to members of people in the airlines for years, I know the answers they want to give, because they'll say, I wish I could answer this. Well, I go out and I do it, because it's my version of sanity. You think airline passengers are huge whiners. You got to see the hotel complainers. My God.
Oh, is that right? A class of their own?
They make the airline people seem normal. It is awful. I mean, the whole, like, I paid $99 worth of an upgrade to a suite, and then they'll just go on for like an hour. I want my suite. You know what? You paid $99 at Best Western. Shut up.
too much. Can you tell us, what's Traveler's Night In?
Traveler's Night In is the use of the hashtag of TNI, and it is the longest-running travel chat on Twitter. It was established in 2009. It's every Thursday at 3:30 Eastern, and we have all sorts of topics that, I mean, we've done road trips, around-the-world journeys, airline disasters, travel food, traveling with kids. We had a topic on travel underwear and undergarments at one point. I kind of got off topic somehow, but I don't know where that came from. It was travel clothing that somehow ended up being about travel comfort, which turned into travel undergarments. but it's fun. I mean, it's 90 minutes. It's 10 questions, a question every 10 minutes. We have a fairly large regular audience, and I think it's the most fun you can have on Twitter. But I'm not biased because I run it.
So for folks who may not be familiar with this kind of a thing, so it's essentially what you do is you follow that hashtag on Twitter.
And just follow TNI, every hashtag TNI, every Thursday at 3:30 p.m. Eastern.
And folks have the option of kind of contributing or just lurking and reading, depending on how engaged they want to be, I imagine, right?
Well, we encourage people to jump in, and we encourage them to not be so serious.
Well, if it's being led by you, it's it probably fits that bill pretty well.
I'm the only guy who can make travel disasters funny. Tell us about your worst holiday experience and then make me laugh about it.
Yeah, well, it sounds very entertaining.
You should jump in.
I think I will.
This week is all about sharing. Actually, it's about going out and promoting your own local area. Tell us why you love where you live, how you travel that's local to you, how you can help your neighbors promote where they live, and helping your neighbors out. It's basically a few 90 minutes of not what we can do for you, but what you can do for others.
Yeah, sounds fascinating. I think I'll take a look at that. So what else are you involved in these days? Anything else interesting?
I don't even know where to begin. I'm trying to unravel the mysteries of the TSA continually. I don't even know where to begin on that one.
Yeah, is there any change, really? I mean, are things with the TSA, with security at airports, pretty much the same as they were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago?
You know, they are from a passenger standpoint. But you look at stuff like they have the liquid bottle scanners that they said, oh, we've got like $6 million to buy them, except they already had $41 million allocated a couple of years ago, and they'd purchased thousands of them, and they're all sitting in a warehouse in Atlantic City. But they announced they had $6 million to buy new ones. Well, what's wrong with a few thousand you've got sitting in a warehouse in Atlantic City? You know, they come out with the whole, the shooting in Los Angeles, and it's okay, we might allow our frontline screeners to use their cell phones in case of emergency, except they own 50,000 portable radios, which means every single frontline person has a portable radio. What's faster, using your radio or taking your cell phone out and dialing 911? You know, it's little issues like that that get under my skin. You know, it's always fun when you challenge them on something and they say, well, where did you read that? Well, I read your report that was given to DHS, that DHS gave to GAO, and here's the report. And the answer back invariably is, well, nobody reads those.
Great.
I mean, I do. What else? I have no life. That's why I read these things. You know?
So what's your sense for the traveling public? Are they just accepting the status quo? Is it just, sort of sheep through the TSA, gauntlet?
There is a sharp dividing line, and there is almost no neutrality. You either just go through it and you give it no thought, or you're one of those people who start screaming. I've seen it more than once. I saw it last Monday, Bradley in Hartford. I don't want to walk to the scanner. It has all this, that, what other, and you're looking at my nudoscope thing, which is a term I haven't used in quite a while. I haven't heard it anywhere, except that those scanners have all been replaced by L3 Pro Vision 3 scanners, which have a picture of like a gingerbread cutout with a cartoon. It just shows a yellow dot if they see something. There's no more seeing you. But these people, like, I'm being radiated. No, those scanners were all removed because they were deemed to be useless.
Yeah, at great expense, too.
Interestingly, the FDA regulates the amount of radiation that goes through your carry-on baggage, but does not regulate the amount of radiation that comes off the scanner used on humans. I always found that interesting. So you're more concerned with my bag being radiated than my person.
Yeah, that doesn't seems backwards, doesn't it?
You know, how about you just fry my bag? I couldn't care less. And we just care about how much radiation I'm getting as a human being. You know, but that would require apparently a congressional hearing that nobody wants to have.
All right, well, this has been pretty good. Rob or David, do you have any questions or anything you'd like to ask Fish?
I want to wish Fish a happy Passover. Let's start off with that. And, no, I like his tweets, and I like TNI. I do sneak off. It's kind of during work hours.
Yeah, you probably don't want to say too much about that, do you, David?
No, not really, but...
Well, it is work for me. It's fun to get paid to do that, I got to tell you. You know,
yeah.
My kid went to school, and they're like, what do your parents do for this and that? And they're like, oh, well, my dad used to be a photographer, and he did all this stuff. Now he plays on Twitter all day, and no one knows what he does for a living.
Sounds like a dream come true.
Now, I got a question for David.
Shoot.
If we're doing the International P3 Orions,
mm-hmm.
How come the Germans and the Dutch have the same aircraft designation? Shouldn't they have different ones?
Well, the reason why the German and the Dutch have the same designations is because the Germans bought them from the Dutch.
Well, that explains that one. Okay.
So the designation stays fixed?
Well, sort of. I'll talk about it in the history segment.
Okay,
But the answer to the question is 5 went to Portugal and 5 and 8 went to Germany, and they kept the same designations because basically the Netherlands decided to sell them off because they couldn't afford to keep them.
Hmm. And then my other question would be, if the U.S. aviation industry is allowed to start selling parts or licensing parts to Iran again, will that include getting parts to P3F?
Besides the parts that they got sold during Iran-Contra, probably not.
So we're not going to see the P3F upgrades, huh?
No.
Oh, well, worth a shot asking.
All right, well, Fish, we want to thank you so much for spending a little time with us this episode. Why don't you, we'll put you on the podium and tell our listeners all the places where they can find you online.
Boy, we're in the spot here. My blog, which is woefully behind, is flyingwithfish.com. You can find me on Twitter at flyingwithfish, on Instagram at flyingwithfish, or you can try to find me on Facebook at Stephen Frischel. Well, actually, I think I'm facebook.com/flyingwithfish. So I'm pretty much just flying with fish.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
One quick question. Have you ever figured out how many times in a day you post something on Twitter on average?
Last week I was down heavily. Although what I love is when I have a week where I have like 1,000 posts, Twitter sends me the message that says, we know that you haven't been around. Please come back to Twitter. which is normally reserved for people who like haven't tweeted in like 90 days. But if I'm somewhere around 1,000 or below, it starts asking me to come back and noticing that I haven't been tweeting much.
1,000 or below. Oh, my God.
Keep in mind that I would say 65% of what I put on Twitter has an actual purpose people have no idea about. I'm usually throwing keywords out. Some of the random crap that I put on Twitter, there's a word in there I'm trying to figure out, and I'm looking for a return on that word. Uh-huh. I also hijack friends' accounts and do it to their accounts as well. I've had friends call me in the morning and go, have you been in my account? No, why? Then why is my account talking about black and white cookies last night at 2 in the morning? Oh, right. I might have used your account for a minute.
Are you serious? You're being serious.
I'm dead serious. I have access to a couple of friends' accounts, and I will use their accounts as guinea pigs. Just like mine, I'm looking for words. There is an actual purpose to a lot of my absolutely useless banter. I did it this week. I was out in San Francisco working for a company who watched me do it, and they were like, you weren't kidding. Nope. I have completely random conversations with an absolute purpose.
Oh, you're a complicated man, Fish.
Feeds my kids, so I know. I have no. You know what? I get paid to play for a living. I can't really complain.
All right. Great. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me. Speak to you guys later.
The man's nuts.
I wonder if he sleeps.
No, he doesn't.
Probably not much. But I know somebody who does sleep, and that's Pete Combs from the National Business Aviation Association. And he's going to tell us what to expect in this week's NBAA Flight Plan podcast.
Hi, guys. Here are four words you can add to your in-flight vocabulary. Climb via and descend via. What do they mean, and when will you hear them? Well, that topic is coming up Monday on NBAA's Flight Plan. You'll find us in the news update section at nbaa.org.
All right. Thanks, Pete. And now it's time for David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian. David, it's all yours.
Thanks, Max. The airplane of the week, the P-3 Orion, the international versions. In 1964, New Zealand became the first international operator when they ordered 5 Deltic P-3Bs. In 1985, a 6th P-3 from Australia was ordered. The Kiwis have continuously updated their P-3s. Rigel 1 took place in 1982. The P-3s were then now equipped with the IRDS and the APS-134. With this upgrade, the P-3Bs were also updated to P-3Ks. Project Kestrel again brought the 6 P-3Ks into SLEEP, or Service Life Extension Program. Kestrel upgraded the wings, tails, and control surfaces. Lastly, the P-3K2 update gave the P-3s an all-glass cockpit, replacing the steam gauges. All 6 P-3K2s are flown by No. 5 Squadron. The second customer to purchase the P-3 was the Royal Australian Air Force. The initial order was for 10 P-3Bs in 1964. Deliveries began in 1968. 11 squadrons at RAF Edinburgh stood up in 1968. 10 aircraft were then supplemented by an order for 10 more P-3Cs, update 2s. In 1975. In 1978, deliveries began so that No. 10 Squadron could be stood up. Eventually, P-3C Update 2.5s were ordered to replace the original P-3Bs. Those P-3Bs were returned to the United States and refurbished for Portugal. Eventually, in 1997, the RAF began to upgrade the Orions to the AP-3C standard. The upgraded challenges and the first 2 AP-3Cs were delivered in 2001, with the final deliveries in 2005. The AP-3C at the time was the most sophisticated maritime patrol aircraft in the world. The Sea Sentinel upgrade gave the AP-3C the ability to fire the Harpoon anti-shipping missiles. Eventually, the AP-3s will eventually be replaced by the Boeing P-8 Poseidon and the BAMS, or the MQ-4C Triton unmanned air system. The third order was for the Royal Netherlands Air Force, and they ordered 13 P-3Cs update 2.5s. The 13 P-3Cs eventually went to a CUP, or Capabilities Upkeep Program. In 2005, the Netherlands sold off their fleet in a cost-saving measure. Now for the alphabet of P3, starting with Argentina. Following Operation Desert Storm, the United States lifted its arms embargo that was started after the Falkland War. The United States Navy sold 6 refurbished U.S. Navy Bs, called Super Bs, to Argentina. They continue to fly and will eventually get harpoon capability. The P-3AM is a P-3B upgraded for Brazil. 12 of these were created using the CASA FITS, or Fully Integrated Tactical System. Chile ordered 8 surplus P-3As from the United States Navy. 3 aircraft were then flown to New Zealand for electronics upgrade. Locally, they are called P-3ACHs. A 4th aircraft was converted to a UP-3A for passenger transport. 2 other airframes were scrapped for parts, leaving 2 more in long-term storage. Of note, all of the Chilean crews were trained at Naval Air Station Willow Grove, an airport this person's never heard of. In 2005, Germany received 8 of the P-3C Cup aircraft from the Dutch Air Force. The 8 aircraft are operated by Marine Flieger Geschwader 3, or Marine Flight Squadron 3. Greece operated the P-3B, again from surplus United States Navy aircraft. The AMARC in Arizona restored the 6 P-3Bs and provided 4 Alphas as spare parts. Greece flew the Bravos from 1997 to 2009. A grounding was occurred because the Grecian economy and the ability of was not able to fund the spare parts or do a sleep program. The first European operation of the Orion was the Royal Norwegian Air Force. The RNAF first started operating it in 1969 and chose the P-3B over the Atlantic or their current stock of HU-16B Albatrosses. 5 P-3Bs would be delivered. In the mid-80s, 2 Royal Norwegian Air Force P-3Bs were modified by NADC in Warminster, Pennsylvania, with upgraded electronics. In 1997, one of the P-3Bs collided with a Russian flanker. Eventually, they would fly 7 P-3Bs and 5 Super Bs would eventually be sold to Spain. 4 P-3C Update 3s would replace the Super Bs. 2 P-3Bs were converted by Naval Air Station Jacksonville to a P-3N standard. The P-3Ns have the ASW electronics removed and P-3C cockpits installed. They are used for coastal surveillance and transport, as well as bounce trainers. Pakistan operates the P-3C Update 2.75, which is an upgrade of the Update 2 or a downgrade of the Update 3, depending upon whom you talk. The Orions were ordered in 1998 and not delivered until 1997 due to the arms embargo because of the nuclear tests. 2 were converted to P-3C AEWs and have the Hawkeye 2000 electronics of the E-2C. In 2010, 2 more Update 3s were delivered for the anti-surface warfare role. In 1998, Portugal was delivered the first of 6 ex-Royal Australian Air Force P-3Bs from Lockheed. The airframes were zero-timed and given a 20-year sleep program. The program was based on the Royal New Zealand Air Force Kestrel program, re-strengthening the wings and control surfaces. The program was eventually canceled in favor of buying 5 of the Netherlands aircraft in 2005. The Republic of Korea, otherwise known as South Korea, actually purchased P-3C Update 3 Plus aircraft after the Palmdale, California plant had closed. The cost of the 8 Orions was $840 million. This included the entire cost of moving production from Palmdale to Marietta, Georgia. They are the only P-3s ever to be built in Georgia. They also wanted to update for another 8 aircraft. However, they took AMARC refurbished Bs and will be bringing them up to P3 Update 3 Plus standards. The newest member is the Republic of China, otherwise known as Taiwan. In 2007, 12 P-3Cs were removed from AMARC and have been modernized by Lockheed Martin. The first Taiwanese Navy P-3Cs were delivered in August 2013. Spain took deliveries in 1973 of 3 Deltic P-3As. All training was done by the United States Navy. In 1977, one of the Alphas crashed. Eventually, 4 more Alphas were leased from the United States Navy until they were replaced by P-3Bs of the Royal Norwegian Air Forces. The leased P-3s were returned with the exception of one, which was donated to the Spanish Air Force Museum. The P-3M is an upgraded P-3B, five of which are now flown by Spain. These are equipped with harpoons and the fully integrated tactical system. In 1989, the Royal Thai Navy ordered three former United States Navy P-3As. In 1995, two of the aircraft were delivered as P-3Ts, and one was followed by the UP-3T Orion in 1996. The UP-3T has been given a strengthened floor and VIP passenger interior and recently redesignated as VP-3T. Well, that leaves three countries. In 1974, Lockheed Martin Corporation delivered the P-3F to the Imperial Iranian Air Force. The P-3F is a P-3 airframe with downgraded electronics. The P-3F also has the prettiest camo of any P-3. Its three-tone blue is unique to any P-3. Six were ordered and one was destroyed testing a Harpoon missile. After 1979, the Islamic Revolution deliveries were discontinued, and three Fs were completed as Cs and delivered to the Navy. Eventually, Iran was down to two P-3Fs. This was due to lack of spare parts due to the arms embargo. It is possible that the two still flying are from indigenous spare parts as well as surplus parts that might have been delivered during the Iran-Contra scandal. Canada, oh Canada, you always have to do things differently. In mythology, Aurora is the goddess who restored Orion's sight. The CP-140 looks like a P-3C, however, it has the anti-submarine warfare suite of two S-3A Vikings. The CP-140 only has 36 sonobuoys versus the Charlie's 48. The electronics was a cost-saving measure. Eventually, 18 Auroras were built. In 1991, the Canadian Forces purchased three surplus P-3Cs without electronics. These would become trainers and bounce birds, and these aircrafts were given the name designation CP-140A Arcturus. One CP-140A is still used for ground training, and the other two were retired to AMARC in 2011 as a cost-saving measure. Lastly, we need to talk about the second largest user and builder of the P-3, Japan. The Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force decided in 1977 that Kawasaki Heavy Industries would produce the P-3C, after having produced the P-2J Neptune under license. The P-3C would replace both the S-2F-1 Tracker and the P-2J. The purchase was to be for 45 of the P-3Cs. Three P-3C Update 2.5s were built by Lockheed Burbank. Five more kits were then built by Kawasaki under Lockheed's supervision. Eventually, the ninth aircraft was built entirely by Kawasaki, and the license went on from there. Starting with the 46th airframe, upgrades were included like updated radar and better control surfaces. From number 70 on, there were Update 3 standards. The remaining 30 aircraft were Update 3 and then Update 3 Plus. In September 1977, the Kawasaki production ended at 101 P-3Cs. Japan also produced nine more aircraft and three specialty variants. The EP-3 is a signals intelligence aircraft, five of which were built. The EP-3 has the mad boom removed and two large domed antennas on the bottom of the fuselage. Three UP-3D aircraft are used as threat simulators. They can also do any electronic countermeasures mission for a secondary operation. Lastly, one UP-3C was built with its large data probe and is used as a test aircraft for electronics as well as a radar calibration aircraft. With that, I think I hit all the nations that are currently flying the Orion. Next week, we get into the special ops, putting out fires, tracking jugs, and hurricanes. So this is David M. Vanderhoof, your historian, Update 3, signing off.
Wow.
Did you do all that from the top of your head?
Hell no.
Oh, I was going to say. What is did you call it a bounce trainer?
Yeah.
What is that?
You take off, you go around the pattern, and you land. And then you take off, you go around the pattern, and you land. Commonly known as bouncing or touch and goes.
Oh, I just never thought of it in the terms of a big four-engine propeller airplane, but okay.
You go around the pattern, right?
Well, yeah, I just you know, I'm not big on touch.
I know that is touch and go.
Yeah. Bounce and go or something. Yeah. Okay. All right.
You bounce. You touch the wheels, then you go full throttle and you go around the pattern. I grew up watching that with P3s. A's, wow. B's, C's, EP3s.
All right. Thanks again, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australian News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, 14th of April, 2014.
Well, g'day, folks, and welcome to the Australia Desk for episode 295. Struth, Grant, if it's April 14th, that means we've missed my birthday. Well, that's fantastic. It's good still to be 29.
Yeah, excuse me while I... Sorry, I hate it when it happens like that.
Would you believe 31?
Sorry, Max, I think you need to go higher.
Yes. Anyway, oh well. I'm sure Vanderhoof will tell everybody how young I am.
Yeah, well, it didn't stop you getting another grading, so well done on getting a new belt.
Oh, yes, yes. I was the karate kid yesterday. Not bad considering, I've only got one working knee, so very
good. Yeah,
Anyway, enough about karate. Let's talk aviation, and let's talk aviation down here in Victoria. There's a couple of stories this week on the radar. This one's talking about Avalon Airport. Now, you've heard us talk about Avalon before. It's kind of sort of Victoria's second airport. At least that's the way they pitch themselves. We have a few domestic flights that go in and out of there, a former Air Force base from many, many years ago. They're pitching themselves very soon to be Melbourne's next international airport.
That's right, mate. They did get permission to become an international airport a little while ago. We reported on that last year sometime. But now it's actually finally starting to move along. And working with HNA Group from China, they're the parent of Hainan Airlines. And so what's happening is Lindsay Fox with his Lin Fox Group, the owner of Avalon Airport, and I might point out Essendon Airport, a.k.a. Melbourne's executive, you might say, if you're in the U.S. They've signed a memorandum of understanding. That means that blah, 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 talk is cheap. We'll wait and see if it actually happens. But they're going to actually work with Hainan Group to start an aviation service between Australia and China within 18 months using Avalon Airport. So it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it's got some potential for the future.
Yeah, I tell you, Avalon Airport, I think, and particularly now that the Qantas maintenance section will be closing down there very, very shortly, that's really a wasted resource down there. Now, of course, Lindsay Fox, the owner of that airport, very keen to have more aircraft going in there to pay some of those exorbitant user fees that he charges to, come within cooey of that airport. But that aside, I think it's actually a good spot to have a second international airport here at Victoria. Where it sits, not quite in the middle, but, it sits between Melbourne, the Central Business District, and, of course, Geelong, which is our second largest city down here in Victoria, and largely unused despite the few domestic flights that go in there. And I think it's a logical choice. And the good thing about it is it's got great freeway access. The main Melbourne-Geelong rail line runs right past the front of that airport, so sticking a spur line in there and having a rail link would be a lot less problematic than, say, running a rail link into Melbourne Airport.
They do need a rail link into Avalon, but funny you should mention rail link into Melbourne Airport. There must be a bit of an election coming soon enough because our state premier is trying to cover up for all the greenies he got upset and the public transport fans by starting work on carving a new tunnel from one side of the city to the other by promising a Melbourne Airport rail link.
One thing you can count on when a Victorian state election comes up, as it will be the case here in November, any incumbent party or at least an opposition, one of them, will promise a rail link to Melbourne Airport. Now, of course, I don't actually know that we actually need one. I think they could improve the Skybus service, which is actually, I think, quite good, that runs up
it's
and down
fantastic.
The freeway. Yeah, it runs up and down the freeway and gets good access. But they seem to be determined to run a rail line into Melbourne Airport. Now, there is a railway line that runs within about 5 kilometres of it already, which is currently a freight line. It wouldn't take much for them to build a line out to the airport and build a station there, assuming Melbourne Airport would want one. After all, they make more money out of parking fees in their car park than they do from anything else, including all their landing fees. So I don't think they'd be all that keen to have it. But if the government forces it upon them, well, so be it. And hey, as you all know, folks, I drive trains for a living and I have a passing interest in aircraft. So, hey, bring it on, I say.
Yeah, funny that. Look, mate, I just think it's hilarious when we actually get the politicians like Dennis Napthine, our premier, on the radio and people are grilling them about it, and they're trying to lock them down to actually make a comment and actually commit and tell the details of how it's going to happen. And all I can think of is one of my favorite movies called Dodgeball, because, mate, he's out there and he's going dodge, dip, duck, dive, and dodge.
They're saying the details for that will come up in the May budget, so I suppose if that happens, we'll see. I mean, you know, hey, like I say, bring it on. It'd be fantastic for, well, be fantastic for me, Grant. It'd be great for me.
You get to drive past Moore Airport.
Yeah, well, that's right. I don't think it'd do much for productivity on the rail system. I don't think my bosses would let me drive trains out there, but anyhow. Speaking of bosses, Grant, let's talk about another boss that does much more exciting things than I do.
We're, of course, talking about Air Marshal Mark Binskin, who is actually going to be promoted to Air Chief Marshal and will wind up being the Chief of Defence Force. He's currently the Vice Chief of Defence Force, and congratulations to him and a number of other gentlemen who are being promoted.
Yeah, now, well, this is a story that actually came out a week or two back. We were going to run it last week, but, you know, we did run a little bit long, as usual.
You did drone on.
We did a bit. We did drone on a bit, so we're going to run that one this week. But interestingly, Grant, recently you caught up with Air Marshal Binskin up there at the Tamora Aviation Museum and recorded an interview, and something I didn't know about him, actually, he's formerly a Royal Australian Navy fighter pilot.
That's right, mate. He used to fly A-4s, and then he joined the RAF at right about the time they were disbanded, the fleet air arm, and became a Mirage pilot.
Oh, there you go. Fantastic. Here's a quick excerpt of that interview.
I was hooked at a young age, and I was lucky enough to get in the Navy and fly in the fleet air arm, then switch to the Air Force.
Okay.
Been fantastic.
So with the air arm, you went through and you flew A-4s?
I flew A-4s for a couple of years, and then I was on an exchange with the Air Force flying Mirages for a couple of years there, and that was when the fleet air arm fixed wing was disbanded with the carrier. I changed over to Air Force fighter combat instructor course. Lucky enough to be in the first cadre of Hornets in the States, and just had a brilliant career. Just haven't flown a bad aeroplane. Actually, they're all good and always great people to work with.
So eventually they moved you out of the cockpit and onto the desk?
Yeah, it has to happen. But it's interesting. You take what you learn in the cockpit and you employ it in a business sense in the staff work as well. Yep. So it is interesting what you can translate from that dynamic world and the tactical world and your thinking to be able to bring into the staff work. I mean, I was lucky. I spent 17 years in the cockpit before they dragged me out. And at the time I thought, oh, what am I going to do? But I actually appreciated the break. And then when you went back into the cockpit again, it made you appreciate the flying that much more. It was great.
Yeah, always good to get back into it.
Mm.
So when you came out, where did you progress from the Hornets? You went through and became in the Canberra and headquarters and so on, yeah?
Yeah, I ended up in a capability development role in Canberra. And was lucky enough to work for John Baker when he was the Chief of the Defence Force as his staff officer for a year. And that gave me the idea that actually I can do this in the staff work and progress there. Went back and was commanding officer of 77 Squadron for 2 years. I was on the Wedgetail program as the project director for 3 years in the Defence Materiel. Then lucky to fly again as Commander Air Combat Group. Lucky to do a tour in the Middle East in the Air and Space Operations Centre. Back, a couple of staff jobs, Air Commander, Chief Air Force and Vice Chief now, so it's great.
Wow.
Yeah. Fantastic. I tell you what, Grant, I think we've interviewed just about every high-ranking Air Force official in the country lately.
Well, we've done pretty well. We've had DCAF, we've had CAF, we've had then Vice Chief Defence Force and now Chief Defence Force. I think that's pretty good.
Absolutely. The full version of that interview is in episode 117 of Plane Crazy Down Under. You know, Grant, one of these days we should get around to making 118, do you think?
Oh, why break a track record? Let's go for 2 months without an episode.
Yeah, let's do that. Well, we're too busy working for the Airplane Geeks and making our video.
There you go. Well, I thought it was Stephen Bam who was working hard on the video.
Well, somebody is. I know it's not me.
There you go.
All right. Well, there we go. Well, I better get busy working on this edit. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Boy, they do. You know, we'll have to get them, see if they can get the get Angus Houston on once this Malaysian thing kind of settles down. He's been quite an interesting fellow as the spokesman for the Joint Coordination Center there in Perth.
Yeah.
Looking for the Malaysian airplane. But I was thinking of those guys when they're doing some pretty fantastic stuff down there in Australia. It kills me to say it, but... Hey, listen, actually, who knows? Maybe one of these days, that would be a dream, wouldn't it? We could all have enough cash to go fly to Australia and do the show in Steve's studio.
Well, that would be very cool.
That would be fun. Okay.
I'm on mute again. Yes, I was well on my way. You know, I was out the door.
All right. Well, Rob, last week we missed the Aviation Minute, so I'm really glad to hear that we're going to have one again this week. And tell us again what we're going to talk about.
Well, first of all, let me apologize for last week. I mean, the minute is so quick that it probably went past and you didn't even see it. It was moving so fast. No, this week we're talking about SATs, Sierra Alpha Tango Alpha Sierra. And it's a synthetic air traffic control system designed to provide traffic advisories at non-towered airports. And it's pretty cool. It's a guy I know that is kind of putting together with some other folks, and I think it's an interesting story.
All right. Here's Rob with his Aviation Minute.
From Chicago, I'm Rob Mark, and this is the Aviation Minute. Something that's always fascinated me about the aviation industry is the never-ending technological innovation we seem to generate, especially in just the last 5 years. Today, I can bring an iPad with me in the Cirrus and access a bundle of valuable resources. I just need to make sure I don't get so distracted that I forget to fly the airplane, of course. I want to tell you a story about some emerging technology that's being regularly nudged along by a friend of mine, Dr. Dave Byers. Dave and I met a few years ago when he was teaching at the Florida Institute of Technology and later at the University of Nebraska's Omaha campus. He also moonlights as an airport consultant focused around the contract tower program. A couple of years ago, Dave mentioned a project he called SATS, for Synthetic Air Traffic Advisory System. It functions a bit like an automated UNICOM to prevent mid-air collisions and runway incursions at non-towered airports. When it's completed, the system will use a computer-generated voice to broadcast traffic advisories to aircraft in the local traffic pattern over a common radio frequency. SATS uses off-the-shelf radar technology created by DTEC Harrier and SRI and doesn't require aircraft to be transponder equipped. Unlike traditional radar, too, SATS doesn't require radar scopes. The entire SATS display can be pumped into an iPad sitting on someone's desk. What I also found really fascinating about SATS is the idea itself, one that emerged from an FAA competition that Dave facilitated with some of his students in 2010 at Nebraska's Aviation Institute. Prompt: students should just think of new ways to solve contemporary aviation problems. Surprisingly, SATS only received an honorable mention in that competition. Byers tested the current SATS system earlier this month at Sun and Fun in Lakeland, Florida. His team of high-tech partners needed to be sure the radar could generate the data needed to carry SATS along to the next step, developing the computer software to make it all come together. But Dave doesn't think creating the software is going to be too tough. He just sees it as a big math problem. He told me, "We just need to create a safety bubble around each airplane and combine that with the X and the Y coordinates, as well as the timestamp of the data piped in from the radar." I'm sure that makes sense to somebody, hopefully the programmers. In an era when FAA appears more and more reluctant to support new contract towers, Byers says SATS will complement the current contract tower program, not replace it. Of course, right now, Byers and his technology partners need a chunk of venture capital to move them forward. But my guess is that SATS is an acronym you're going to hear more about in the next year or two. By the way, did I mention that the Sun and Fun test was successful? You can watch a video of the demonstration on SATS' Facebook page. Just log into Facebook and search for SATS. S-A-T-A-S. For the Aviation Minute, I'm Rob Mark. See you next time.
That's pretty interesting, Rob. Is funding the big issue that's preventing this from moving forward?
Well, it is at the moment. I think they're close to finding some venture capital. The two companies, well, the number of companies, the radar groups and a few others that Dave's working with said that they funded their way to Sun and Fun, so it because it was important enough for them to have a setup to gather data
to prove that this was all going to work. And again, I think they're a lot closer than many people that are watching this thing might think. But it's pretty cool when you see it work. The only thing they don't have yet is the computer generated voice. And I've already agreed to do it for them. Well, I auditioned for it, but they didn't like the first thing I said, which was, you know, when airplanes got close, you'd go, Jesus, look over there. Oh my. They yeah. thought that might just scare people rather yeah. than
they were probably looking for something
them.
A little different.
Yeah, so I'm going to work on it.
Okay. All right. All right, now here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Hi, this is Peter Johnson, and I'm standing at the end of 27 right at London Heathrow Airport, and I go back now 40 years from when I first stood here watching the aircraft come in one after the other, a minute apart, and I really got that bug that led to me being where I am today, I suppose, back at the fence, fingers in the fence, watching the planes go by. It's a wonderful feeling. It's just great to see these aircraft, particularly on this lovely sunny April day, come in. I can see at least three or four aircraft out in the pattern over London coming on to finals, and it's just a great place to be at the moment. And as David said, one of the greatest views is, of course, when you're on an aircraft, it's the window seat looking out, but also there's a great seat here and a great view here, standing with your fingers in the fence, watching the aircraft go 50 feet above your head and steam over, that feeling of power and gracefulness as these big 100 ton plus aircraft rumble in one after the other and land and disgorge the hundreds of people. And a thing that I suppose really sticks with me today as I stand here is, of course, the ongoing issues associated with the Malaysian 777 as British Airways A319 just passes me by. And that is that I passed through Heathrow earlier on my way to a meeting, and I've come back now to just have 10 minutes at the end of the runway before I drive off home. And I've seen maybe five or six British Airways 777s, the Intercontinentals coming in the morning, and a few of the lunchtime flights just recently. And I suppose what still amazes me, apart from that fascination with these great aircraft, is how can an aircraft of that size in this day and age go missing? We all understand how big the seas and the vast spaces are that unfortunately this aircraft looks like it's gone down in, but it still just amazes me seeing the size of this aircraft and seeing it come over me, how in 2014 we've allowed that to disappear and not know where it is and struggle to find it. Another baby Airbus, as I call them this time, from SAS is just coming over the top. So nice pretty red engines, big blue tail, as that just disappears behind me. So yeah, it's really astounded me to see these great aircraft, and I've had the chance to drive around the back of Heathrow and park up pretty close, maybe 50-100 yards from some parked aircraft, and just have a look at them, and they're ginormous. They're just so big. So I'm astounded and flabbergasted by humanity's inability to track its own kind on something like this. But anyway, enough of that. I'm having a great time watching the aircraft coming in. I'm sure many of you do similar things, but on a day like today, sunny blue skies, there's no greater place to be than I am here. Now,
Saying that, we have had a few rainy days, and it really made me think about some of the museums that we've talked about in past episodes. And one great museum that nobody should miss if you've got the opportunity in the south of England is the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust. And I'll just play this from interviews and excerpts from a segment I recorded for the Geeks a few years ago at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust. Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Gnat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this. Now, one of the reasons that the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust came to mind, it's not the biggest aviation museum in the world, it's not probably the best in the world, but it's free. And that's always a great catch. Unfortunately, we all understand why, but many museums do cost a significant amount of money to attend and view. And sometimes it's nice to get something back. And these guys do a wonderful job. So if you have the opportunity, if you're ever in London or just south of London, go to Farnborough. You can go to the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust. You could also go to the National Aerospace Library, which is free and houses some of the most amazing artifacts from aviation around the world, but particularly from the UK. So do visit those, and do continue to send us your details of great museums around the world. And don't forget to tell us those ones that are free as well. So I'll just watch this British Airways Airbus come in, and then that's me, Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks at the end of 27 right at Heathrow.
You know, what's really funny about that is that most of us that are past the age of 30 have probably spent time back at the places that we used to hang out as kids watching airplanes. I know Peter's done that at London. In fact, I've been in that same spot there near 27, right at Heathrow.
Wow.
And, certainly at some of the New York airports, but certainly O'Hare and Midway. And, you know, you just go back and it doesn't even seem like it was very long ago. And, but it kind of has been.
Wow, I didn't know Peter was old enough to have been watching airplanes 40 years ago.
Well, he was two.
Yeah, he
was two.
I guess.
Or was it three, Peter? I forgot.
All right, so again, thanks to Peter Johnson for the Across the Pond segment.
Can I just interrupt with one minor thought?
Can I say no?
No.
Okay, go ahead.
it's about listeners. And this last week I was down at... in Dallas at the Texas Department of Transportation conference, airport conference. And I was just amazed when I was down there. I had to give a talk, and I cannot tell you how many people came up to me at the end of the talk. They don't even remember what I said, actually, but they really liked the Airplane Geek Show. I mean, I had a number of them that came up from around the area that said, wow, we listen and we really like it. So, wow. And any of those of you that are listening, if you have any clue what I talked about, please let me know. But I just wanted to say thank you to all those nice folks down there in Dallas who took the time. And I ran out of Airplane Geeks buttons. I didn't think I was going to need that many.
Well, that's great. It's good to hear. All right. Want to give a quick shout out to Ducky and the crew over at OtherPeople'sAirplanes.com. That's, of course, is a video podcast, and they've been covering Sun and Fun, which we haven't talked about really this year. So if you would like
to
see...
Because we didn't get to go.
We didn't go, but Dave and the guys, they went, and so check out OtherPeople'sAirplanes.com for some really good videos.
I can't remember. Is his name Ducky or Goosey Ducky. Or Turkey?
Ducky.
Or it's Ducky? Okay.
Yeah, I think it even Fluffy? Says Ducky on his shirt now.
Oh, doesn't? Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
Dave. I can never get that straight.
All right, moving on to some listener mail. We heard from Dirk in Belgium. I got a nice long email. This is an interesting topic.
Yes.
Dirk says that last week, he writes, I attended an event and had the pleasure to talk to a person from Boeing. Thanks to your podcast, I was very well aware of the Air France 447 investigation, and I asked him why Boeing is uploading far less real-time sensor data to its maintenance facility compared to Airbus, even though the 777 is a fairly recent airplane. He explained to me that for the Boeing 777, airlines have the option to upload engine and other sensor data. So it is up to the airline to decide whether they pay an additional fee to upload and store these data on the Boeing or other cloud. Obviously, Malaysian Airlines decided not to do that, hence the difficult search. And then he goes on, now my main issue is, I feel that the public has a right to know which airlines have real-time monitoring and which ones have not. It may influence the choice of flying a specific airline. The MH370 flight mystery has shown that this is relevant information. He says, are you aware of such lists detailing the airplane types as well as airlines that have real-time data feed links to headquarters? Interesting question. I think the answer is no, there is no list. Are you guys aware of anything?
No. No, I found that question really interesting myself, and honestly, I'll bet you that the airlines would never release that.
Yeah, I think you probably are right. Now, just so everybody understands, these services, these real-time monitoring services are sold by the airframers and the engine manufacturers as kind of an option to the airlines. It's a service that you can pay for and receive. Some airlines take advantage of that. Some don't. For whatever reason. But there is a cost to it. The benefit to the airlines depends on the system, but oftentimes these are maintenance systems so that, for example, when the aircraft is in flight, there may be some sensor data that indicates that a component that's line replaceable, let's say, is becoming due for replacement. And so you can have the mechanic at the destination there with the spare part there. They can go change it and off they go and no delay, things like that. But it's interesting how these systems never designed for things like locating aircraft has come to play a role with MH370.
Well, I think that's all going to – well, I shouldn't say I think it's all going to change because I thought it was going to change after the Air France group lost that airplane in 2009. And here we are 5 years later, and we've got the same problem all over again.
Yeah, and we talked about this a lot back then, thinking that I think many of us thought that there would be a change and that some of the issues surrounding the difficulties with transmitting data. Some people talk about the volume of data and how that's a problem, but I think, Rob, you've mentioned it's not necessary to transmit all the data all the time.
No.
That some periodic kind of thing makes a lot of sense.
No, well, I don't claim to be a software guy or that satellite kind of data man, but all we would really need is maybe a half a dozen pieces of information every 3 or 4 minutes in a burst. aircraft ID, altitude, heading, airspeed, you know, and maybe the state of the aircraft. You know, the engines are running fine, the pressurization's up, electrical system is fine, and off we go. And if those came down from airplanes in a burst, which would take probably a half a second from wherever they are, we wouldn't be in this kind of situation because we would have known where this airplane was. We also need transponders. It can't be turned off. Not the cockpit versions, but we need an extra one in the belly somewhere that somebody cannot turn off.
Yeah, something hardwired, right?
You know, yeah, really, because you know, there's just no reason for that anymore.
Where do you send the data? Who's responsible for the data?
Well,
how long do you keep the data?
I don't know. I don't claim to have all those
questions. Can it be answered?
Yeah, but nobody's even addressing those questions. We're not even talking about that. They're not even at the first step, let alone, you know, the security aspect of the information. We're not even that far.
But those are the questions they're going to use as the excuses for not doing it.
Yeah, but that was also the same thing they said 5 years ago. And the point is that nobody dug into it, except that I'll tell you one thing. I did find something doing some research for a book. I found something from ICAO that came out in, I think it was mid-2012, that was as a result of the Air France accident. And an ICAO working group made a recommendation that the airlines upgrade their tracking abilities for aircraft in oceanic and polar regions. And it just disappeared. Nobody ever knows if it was ever acted on or where it fell through the cracks or if it was tossed in a garbage can or what. But to the listener's email, you know, people these days do actually, I think they are smart enough to realize that there's information out there. And I think more people are going to start saying, hey, we want to know. And I think that's another issue airlines are going to have to start dealing with.
And a search like this is enormously expensive. I mean, there's different numbers out there, but and I don't know if you recall how much Air France 447 was reported to have cost, the search and all that.
You know, they said it was somewhere around 25 million euro, 20 to 25 million. And we're already probably double that at this point in dollars, I should say, here. And we haven't found anything yet.
And we haven't found anything. Of course, that's the people that foot that bill are not the people that would not the airlines, right? So that there's no economic. Well, this sounds harsh, but there's no economic incentive for the airlines to spend the money to transmit this kind of data.
Nope.
At least from the standpoint of having to pay the consequences.
Nope. You're absolutely right, and that's one more thing that David could add to his list. And David, I don't disagree with you on what you said about, you know, where's the data going to go and who's going to maintain it. I agree. And I'm just saying that's a part of the conversation, but we haven't even gotten that far yet because nobody wants to budge.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a sad thing, but that's, you know, we'll be lucky if we ever find this airplane.
All right, we received an email from Rick. We had spoken in a recent episode about the status of the 787 battery issue, and we just gave a really kind of a quick summary of that. Rick provided something with more detail that's maybe worth going through really quickly, just so folks are up to speed on it. He said that when the incidents happened in early 2013, the fleet was grounded, and basically four separate initiatives were begun. He says, first, the NTSB began an investigation. As of March 2014, the NTSB announced that they had finished their investigation with their report due out in the fall. I have a link to an article on that. Next, the Japanese Safety Board began a parallel investigation. No word on status I have seen. He says they may be expanding their investigation to the January 2014 incident of battery venting. Next, he says, the FAA began an overall investigation of the 787 design, manufacture, and assembly. In March 2014, the FAA published a 71-page report basically saying the plane was safe to fly. And we have a link to that report.
And then finally, Boeing began a redesign effort for the lithium-ion battery and enclosure, which was tested, approved by the FAA, and retrofitted into the fleet and future production. He says this was done without knowing the root cause and was primarily focused on containment, not prevention, which is, I think, the big point that we made when we talked about it. Yeah, he says in January 2014, there was another fire in one cell on a JAL airliner with the venting outside the plane. That's how that was supposed to operate. We have a link to that. And then finally, Rick says it's hard to anticipate the NTSB coming out this fall with another solution, given the FAA has more or less painted them into a corner with their overall approval of the 787. He says it will also be interesting if the Japan board comes up with a different root cause and or solution. He says, my take is that this issue is still open, at least until the fall of 2014. So thanks, Rick, for a really good summary of where we are with the battery issue. We should probably mention the email from Patrick. We talked about that video, the rock and the skydiver. If you recall, that video has been making the rounds where a skydiver was photographing and caught kind of a rock blasting past him. And the headlines read that he had been narrowly missed by a meteorite. So Patrick says that there's a lengthy thread on this subject in the Minor Planet mailing list. And pretty, well, let me say, first of all, the Minor Planet mailing list is, this is for a lot of, astronomy aficionados. I think generally the quality of the participation there is pretty good. But he says that, Patrick says that pretty much everyone there agreed pretty early on that it was just an Earth rock. Some suspected another jumper higher up dropped it. Others suspected it had been packed accidentally or otherwise in the parachute of the jumper who shot the video. So he says, checking the numerous online comments from jumpers involved, they are now thinking it did fall out of someone's parachute when it opened. He says, as someone who has been jumping since the 60s, I know for a fact that this is not the first time when someone has packed some, quote, additional equipment into a friend's rig. So very interesting. Maybe it really wasn't as dramatic as we all thought. On the other hand, I kind of get the impression that these jumpers, man, they might be kind of crazy.
You ever seen them? Boy,
they jump out of airplanes.
Yeah, they're jumpy.
And then we need to kind of wrap this up, but Bob sent us an email. He says he has a question, been bugging him for a while. The mosquito KA144 was restored, he says, in New Zealand, as you no doubt know. And it's, again, flying.
Oh, I want to hear the answer to this because I know David has it, I hope.
David's got it.
I want to know the answer.
Time to come off mute, David. Under those engine cowlings, there lurks a Merlin V12, But in all the pictures, there are only 5 exhaust stubs. The rear 2 stubs are Siamese into 1. And he asks why. So, David, how come we have a V12, but only 5 exhaust stubs on a side?
Because the 5 and 6 stub are, you answered the question, are blended together because of to reduce the heat signature on the wood that was holding the engines attached to the fuselage. They've eventually rectified that, and there are later mosquitoes with 6 stacks. Now, if you're a real modeling geek, that's why you would know that.
All right. So thanks for that, David. Yeah, that's sort of fascinating. And I think I've seen that question come up in the past, actually. And it tells you we have some observant listeners that would notice that. So, all right, we have some more emails, but we're kind of out of time. So I think we're going to bring this one to a close. We want to thank our guest, Stephen Frischling, Fish. You can find him, well, just look for Flying with Fish. He's on Twitter, Flying with Fish. He's also got the boardingarea.com blog, Flying with Fish. We also want to thank our contributors, Graham McCarron and Steve Vischer. They're at playingcrazydownunder.com. And Peter Johnson at aviation-extended.co.uk. No leading E on extended. All right, this is the part of the show where we tell folks where they can find us online. Rob, let's start with you. Where do they find more Rob Mark?
Yeah, if you need that sort of thing, I guess. thank God some people do want us all, I guess, right? That's a good thing. Jetwine.com, Jetwine on Twitter. I'm on Facebook somewhere under my real name. AIN Safety, I'm the editor there. And The Aviation Minute and hanging around on street corners everywhere, reading the newspaper, looking like I don't have a real job.
Aviation Minute is on iTunes now. Is that correct?
I should say that. It just started about a week and a half ago. It's on iTunes. And also they can go to jetwine.com/aviationminute and find it there.
Good. All right. David Vanderhoof, where do folks find you?
Usually on mute. But besides that, you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on every Friday morning with my co-host Max Flight for the UAV Digest. And you can find me on Facebook and various airports and such like that.
All right. And I'm Max Flight. Look for me on Google Plus and Twitter. Also, as David mentioned, at theuavdigest.com. Also, you can find me at runwaygirlnetwork.com for the Passenger Experience podcast, the PaxX podcast that I co-host with Mary Kirby. You can find show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com. Find lots of links there, a bunch of photos, other great stuff. If you want to go straight there and want to use the shortcut, that's airplanegeeks.com/295. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. Just look for Airplane Geeks. Also, you can stream us from Stitcher.com and also TuneIn.com. I understand that Stitcher has a new app for the Windows phone. So if you're a Windows phone user and you'd like to listen to us there, now that you can do that. If you want to send us an email, the address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have a listener line where you can leave us an audio message. Binay, what do you have to say?
The Airplane Geeks want to hear from you, so please give them a call at 361-GEEKS-01.
Thanks, Binay. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening.
Simba says bye.
Simba says, I heard Simba every now and then rattling her chain.
Yeah. He's a he, though.
Did you know, I say
Max,
she?
Max, how long have I been doing this for? I mean,
my deepest Simba's apologies to Simba.
Simba's a boy. And it's kind
I hope
of
he's not too
like
sensitive.
Rainbows and unicorns, I guess, huh? Just kind of, it's very ethereal.
I heard someone make a reference to unicorn jerky. Boy, I thought that was pretty harsh. It was on some television program, unicorn jerky.
I think it had to do with the fact that people that believed in unicorns were jerks. Maybe that's what it was about. I don't know.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood. We also have an Australia desk report.
I'm now disbanding the Fleet Air Arm and became a Mirage pilot.
Oh, there you go. Fantastic. Here's a quick excerpt. How do you say that?
Excerpt.
Here's a quick excerpt. Well, that sounds very cool, Grant. Here's a quick summary of that interview.
I keep going back to excerpt, don't I?
I can't say that word, excerpt. Here's a quick excerpt of that interview.
Sorry, I talked over you.
Here's a quick excerpt of that interview.
Yay, he got it out. Woohoo!
There's some bloopers.
So to speak.
So how do you edit a podcast, Granny? I forget.
I don't know. Don't you just go click, click, click and it's done?
I don't know. I'm an old man now.
Level it.
Oh, I'm nearly 35.
Oh, dude. Pull the other one.
You mean like an Airplane Geek song?
Yeah. You know, like, you know, David could play a musical instrument and I could do the bass and...
David's got a voice.
Can you sing, David?
He left the building.
Okay, well, I guess the thought of a song was more than he could bear.
We scared him away.